What should we talk about?
Well, I guess the first thing
you asked. You asked the question.
No,
we'll try to
work the other way. Now, I'm still a little confused. Were either of you in the Women's Buckle at all, or did you help organize?
Yes, I was. I was the recording secretary, and then I was recording secretary and treasurer, and then I became the president.
How did the local first get organized?
It was organized when I came in. Sarah Rosner was the original president of the ladies' local. The lady that you're supposed to be doing this for, or that recommended it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea why it was originally organized? What their purpose was?
Well, the purpose was to see that the women got the same rights and the same privileges as the men, because, you know, the women always took second place. The men were always in first place, regardless.
Do you have some examples of that?
Yes. Do you remember the time when our own insurance, where the men were getting $14, was it?
You know, we were the first one. I mean, we'll talk back and forth so that we can remind each other of things. You remember, we were the first ones that originated the checks for the unemployment compensation.
Yes.
That was our idea. Our union originated that idea, and then it came out and everybody else followed it. But you remember when we were working, and we were working 2-3 hours a week, and we were getting checks from our union over here. That was one of the things. Then, I can't remember now because it's so far back, but I think that's where it originated, that we were getting less than the men were getting. Because they considered them heads of family.
Yes, but when they came to the insurance, when they used to take out for the insurance, they used to take the same amount out as they did for the men.
Yeah.
And when it came, when we were on sick leave, and not on leave, sick leave only when we were sick, you know.
Sick, yeah, we were
sick
off.
Benefit,
sick.
The men would always get, I believe,
more?
$4 or $5 a week more than the women. And it got so that when I was a joint board officer, and I know I took the floor several times at the joint board, and I objected to it because I said, why should we get less when we're paying the same amount of money, we're working the same hours, we're making the same pay, and why should we be getting less than the men?
That's
so
right.
They gave us, for an excuse they gave us, that the women used to stay home more than the men.
Yeah, that was their excuse.
But we kept it up, and several times at a joint board meeting, the same question came up until it got so that the people were getting roiled up about it, women, and more women were coming into the trade.
Yeah.
Did you see?
Was this around 20?
Around, well, it had to be under 20, yes.
And more women were coming into the trade right along, and more.
Why was that? Was there a particular appeal with the clothing industry, or?
You mean that the women, more women came in?
Yes.
Well, it was, a lot of people, you know, most of the people that worked in the tailoring line were all people that were foreigners, that were coming from different countries. And when one would get in, when the rest of the family would come, they'd bring in some more. And it seemed like sewing was more of a woman's job than it was a man's. Of course, we had men that were operators too. We had a lot of men that were operators.
Yes.
But the men mostly were like in the cutting room or threading.
Cutters.
Yeah. But there were always more operators than there were in any other part of the trade. I mean, they had to be more operators in order to produce, you know. But the wife, she's telling you the original story why the women got riled up was because we were paying the same amount of dues. There was no difference in the dues. I mean, they didn't give us a break as far as the dues were concerned. Yet, when it came down to the benefits, we weren't entitled to it because the excuse was that the women got sick more than the men did.
That was the excuse for you not getting the same insurance.
That's right. The same benefits. The same benefits.
But then it got so that the women were taking a more active part, you know, and they figured that it was wrong. If they paid the same thing into it, they should get the same thing out of it.
And
so then
little by little, the women were getting, were fighting for their rights, and that's how they formed the Women's Local.
What kind of tactics did they use about, you know, trying to press their rights? Did they approach the joint court, or did they talk
to themselves? Naturally, the joint court has staff meetings every week. And then they have a general executive board meetings. And naturally, they must bring these things up to the staff. They have to bring it up to the joint board. First, the staff meets. They take it up with the staff. Then they meet with the joint board, and they take it up with the joint board. And
we have our local meetings every month. The only time we don't have local meetings are the 3 months of the summer.
Yeah,
June. Yeah. So then we would get up, like she'd get up, or I'd get up, and we'd talk at the local meeting. Then our joint board delegates would bring it up to the joint board, because that's the highest body as far as the representation of the people is concerned. And then they would bring it up to the staff.
Yeah.
You see, every local has eight joint board members.
According to the membership,
so many joint board delegates. And then there's one spokesman that gives
a report every joint board meeting.
What the local took up at their last meeting.
So before 275 was actually formed, and women were getting angry about some issues like the insurance thing, how did they go about voicing that in their own particular locals?
Own particular locals.
You see, before,
and then our spokesman brings it up to the joint board.
When the union was first organized, we had a Polish local, we had an Italian local, we had a Lithuanian local, they had a Jewish local too, if I'm not mistaken, didn't they?
No, not that I know of.
No?
That the All-American local they used to call 39.
Oh, is that what they called it?
No.
Well, anyway, that was the local, see, she was in before I was. And that they'd get up and voice their opinion, you know, at their local meeting. And that's how it gradually got to the point where they give the women a little bit more recognition, and little by little, we got to form the women's local. That's the way it was explained to me when I came in the local, because it was already organized when I came in.
I know when I came in, Sarah Rosner was the...
Everything happened.
When you came in, you were saying when you came in.
I didn't belong to their local. I belonged to the Passmakers local, 144.
Did you participate in any?
I participated in all the women's affairs.
Every one of them.
I sold.
We used to have we never had a big membership.
Why was that?
Well, you know how locals are. Each local would try to get all the members that they could. So naturally, for instance, I could take Karchak and Marx, the shop that I worked in. I was in the pants local before I came into the women's local. Mm-hmm. Well, everybody that was in my department in the pants local was obligated to belong to the 144, see? And it was kind of hard to take women away from any local. Nobody wanted to do that to get in wrong with another local, you know what I mean? But there were women that went anyway, they didn't care. You know what I mean? And that's how they got together. They never had a real big membership. So in order to exist, where all the locals used to run a dance or something every year, so our local was so small that we were never able to run a dance. We couldn't sell enough tickets. So we used to run a dinner every year. And we girls did all the cooking, and we used to have
to depend on the other locals.
We had to depend on the women from the other locals to come over to help us, and she was one of our biggest helpers. Not only worked with us, she bought tickets, sold tickets for us, and she helped us in the kitchen with everything. We'd come here for 2-3-4 days at a time, we'd come cooking and get all the stuff ready, and then people like her would come over and help us with the serving, and they'd sell tickets for us. And that's how we used to be able to send girls as delegates to our convention when we had a convention every other year. That's how we used to accumulate our money.
Rose, how did people react to you when you wanted to leave the Pantsmakers local and go into the women's local?
Well, I didn't have any trouble because I was very active, and I was active no matter what locals we had in the building here, they always asked us girls to come over to help when they have anything doing. They would always come into the ladies' local and ask Clara Leon, our business agent, then, because Sarah Rosner was out then. And they'd come over and ask her if she could have a group of girls to help them. And we used to come in, and of course, she was asked also, even though she wasn't in our local, but she was asked also.
What was the general receptiveness of all the locals and the joint board to the formation of the Women's Local? Did they honestly see a need for it?
If they wouldn't have seen that, they wouldn't have given us the charter. We wouldn't have been able to get a charter for it.
And you've got to give the Women's Local the credit, because the Women's Local took the initiative in everything.
Right.
Anything that went on, whether it came to running any affair, to put the thing over, they couldn't put it over.
They couldn't put it over without our help.
Unless
we were always there. We had a dramatic club. We had a choir. We had a gymnasium. And we had a dancing group here. We taught ballet. We had a teacher coming in to teach ballet. We had everything. And the women were the ones that were in back of everything. If it wouldn't have been for the women, they wouldn't have had that activity. The only activity that they had was a concert. Mm-hmm. They used to give a concert every May 1st. Remember?
Yeah.
That was before the communist Russia started to celebrate Labor Day on May the 1st. As soon as they started, we stopped because we didn't want to be associated with them because we weren't communists, you know. And the only activity they had actually was a concert, and each local used to run a dance by themselves, right? They used to run an affair once a year in order to make money so that they would be able to send delegates when we used to have our convention, because our convention was always every other year. So, but the ladies' local was always asked. Anytime that we had any kind of a political meeting, for weeks and weeks before we had election, we were the ones that used to go over to the different congressional districts and sit there and work night after night, And we were never compensated for anything. The only thing they gave us over there was coffee. That was all. Everything was done on our own expense. We women have paid the price for everything all the way down the line. Always.
Do you think that in some cases you were used because of that? Because you
Well, this was general. This was national. I mean, it wasn't anything that they picked on us in particular.
Yeah.
It wasn't, I mean, we can't say that they actually did it because they wanted to be mean to us or anything like that.
Yeah.
It seemed like the world originated that way, that the women always were in second place. They never were in first place with the men. They always came after the men. The men were the ones that led the parade and everything. But when it came to actually doing the work, it was the women that put in all the hours and all the hard work. It was always that way.
How did you feel about that? Did you say, okay, you know, we're going to have, that's our lot. We're going to have to be putting all that extra work in because...
The women never objected when it came to doing something that benefited the organization.
That's right. We would never hold back.
Never hold back, because we knew if it was good for one, it's good for all. So they never objected. And believe me, there isn't a thing, not one thing, that they can say that they ever were turned down by our
never. Members. You know, we used to, the boys used to come and pick us up. Well, Lou had the car, so they used to, because she's been driving for years, mostly. And she used to meet us at the picket line. But most of them business agents used to come and pick me up at 5:30 in the morning to go on a picket line. We used to go on a picket line when the snow was that hot.
And then go to work in the morning.
Yeah, and then go to work from there, wherever we were at. Never got paid a dime. Not even car fare did we get. You know what we got? A sweet roll and coffee. Because a lot of mornings it was terribly cold. And we lost time. I wish I had a penny for all the time that I lost when I worked on 19th and Hallsville. I used to go down to work an hour and a half late, and I remember some of the fellas, how they used to wisecrack us, a bunch of dopes. You're going down there, giving them all that help. Are you getting paid for it? Who's paying for the time you're losing?
Yeah.
Now, when they go out on the picket line, they get paid for every step they take. They get paid for their fare, they get paid for their lunch, they get paid for their time. We never got paid nothing.
Rose, how would you react to those people that called you dopes?
Well, listen, you know, there have to be martyrs for the cause. And we always felt, like Agnes told you, we weren't doing it for our personal, although we naturally, we wanted to have the benefits as well as anybody else. But since we couldn't get them any other way, the only way was to cooperate. Because we're not only helping them, we're helping ourselves too. So I mean, you're just going against yourself if you refuse to help. You know what I mean? We believed in what we were doing. We believed in what the union was doing. We were back at them 100%. And naturally, like I told you, and I don't care what line of work it is, whether it's social, religion, or anything else, there always have to be the people that have to be martyrs for the cause. There's always a group that has to suffer for it. Nothing was ever gained, no progress has ever been made in this world, unless there's been a few people that have had to suffer for it. And then the others coming on. You know, last night I enjoyed so much seeing Clarence Gale.
I listened to it.
And I remember
there was so much truth to that.
Yeah.
Believe me,
you know that show.
So many memories.
Yeah. You remember when he used to be in debate at the Masonic Temple downtown? I was just a young girl then, and I used to go down there to listen on Sunday afternoon because I always enjoyed debate.
He was good too.
Oh, he was terrific. I could still see him with his hands.
This narrator.
Oh,
he was good.
What's his name? Henry Fonda.
He was
perfect. And you know, they showed it exactly the way it was on stage a few months ago here in Chicago. Mm-hmm. They had exactly the same thing, with the intermission, the audience, and everything, perfect. I really enjoyed it. It was, you know,
Eugene B. Debs, I'll never forget when Eugene B. Debs was buried. We had a special train that left here from Chicago to his funeral in Terre Haute, Indiana.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then who do you think? Who do you think started the union in Chicago? This is where the union started, here in Chicago, you know. The spark was right in Chicago in the paint shop.
Yes.
It was women that walked out of the shop first.
That's right.
The women were the first ones to walk out. Bessie Hillman and some of the pantsmakers, seamers. Yes. They were pantsmakers. That's where the union originated, really, right here in Chicago. Then later on, they made the headquarters in New York City, you know. But this is where the spark was. That's why we always
came. Sidney Hillman and all of them came.
They all came. All Frank Rosenblum.
Most of our general executive
board. All of them. They're all originally from Chicago.
Do you think that there were any specific problems with organizing in Chicago?
Well, there were before the general organizing started, you know, after they seen the Hotshot and Marx, they started to organize, because I know in 1915, I was out on strike in 1915, and I didn't know nothing about a union. I was only 16 years old, although I started in the trade when I was 14 years old, but that was in 1913, because I was 14 years old in 1913. And in 1915, I was out on strike, and I didn't belong to the union. But I didn't even know what the word union meant, you know. Mm-hmm. And then when we started talking to some of the people, you know, that were organizing, and they told us the meaning of what it meant to be organized and to belong to a union and what their motive was, well, we thought it was a good idea. But then I worked for a small contractor, and we were contracting work for Banner and Progress, and they told us that we had to go back to work because they were only contractors, and they didn't have the say-so, and we'd have to go back to work till the time would come that they could negotiate with Banner and Progress.
Yeah.
And that's how I went back to work.
Mm-hmm. See, the places that organized first, the Hotshot and Marx were the first.
And from 1915 up to 1919-1920, that's when the big drive came in.
Then they start. See, Hotshot and Marx went out first, and then from Hotshot and Marx it went to Kuppenheimer, and
The cook matter didn't go until late.
Till later, that's right.
Yeah, I think
International and all them were on first, before about Cup and Rimmer.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Were there any women active organizing in that big drive?
Yes, there were a lot of women active in organizing the drive. Yeah. I know
a bunch from the pants job.
Yeah.
So that was, I mean, it was a common practice then for them to be?
Yes, they took an active part. I had a sister that was out on strike. So it was in the 1910 strike, and she was walking with it. Like the time she didn't even work in our January and March.
My mother was, my mother couldn't speak good English. Because when she came here, she was 14 years old. She was just a young girl. And she got married in the South, in New Orleans. And my mother used to work in the shop. She was a finisher, a hand worker, And of course, they had Italian people come over to talk to her, to join the union and all that. So then when we girls got in it, she used to send us. She used to make this fun picket line, but I got a kick out of it. Well, my sister Lena, she's 3 years older than me. She was on a picket line. My mother used to send me with her so that she wouldn't be alone. I was supposed to be protecting her, so she'd have somebody with her.
It was a tailor shop. There were two tailor shops on the block that I lived in. One small one was downstairs.
Did you live near Lamb? My mother worked for Lamb and Anderson.
And then a little further down was another shop. We used to see these women walking with these coats, on their head and on their shoulders, where they were taking home.
They used to take the work home
to finish the armholes and the neckline and all that. They used to finish all that at home, and then they'd bring it back and carry it, big bundles on their heads. I remember that as clear as
day. My mother did
and
that.
And pants, my mother used to finish pants by hand at home.
Sure, my mother used to do that.
Was that a general practice, or when you
no, that was a general practice.
They were all foreigners, and that's the way they broke them in when they first got in the little shop.
Yeah, that's right.
My mother was working for three different companies at the same time, because my father had already died, and we were five children. And that was her sole support. I mean, this lady next door, she would work for a different shop. And she said to her, "Missus, you want some work? I'll bring it for you." So they said, and we girls, I was overcasting by hand when I was 10 years old. I was doing hand work after school, helping my mother. That's how my mother raised us.
That's right.
We
were left with three children. My mother was a widow, and I was the youngest one. And that's why when I was 14 one day, the next day my mother went out and got me an H card so I could go to work. My sister took me by Cooney and Fisher. Yeah, but I didn't work very long there. Then I went to the contracting shop. Mm-hmm.
Did you have any feelings about knowing that you were going to have to work? Were you angry or depressed?
No, I was glad. I was very happy.
Why were you glad?
I was glad because I get out and I always thought,
we help our mothers because things were so bad at home that, you were glad to be able to be a family.
I was glad I couldn't.
We're going to have the advantages that you kids have today where you can go to college. Like all my nieces and nephews, they just graduated college, and the next week two of them got married already. I mean, the parents have been working all their life just to give them a good education. We weren't that privileged.
Were there certain things about shop conditions in Chicago around the time the local was organized that were directly related to the
conditions? If you wanted to see sweatshops, yeah. Well, believe me.
Could you describe one to me?
I could. Somehow they used to sit. I can't show you today because my leg is bad. But the men would sit like this with their legs underneath them, the real tailors.
That's why they crossed. These were the tailors. They had their legs crossed like this.
Yeah.
When they were.
They'd sit and work, and a lot of them would get round shoulders. And then the operators,
but a lot of them used to carry their own machines.
Home. Yeah,
on
their back.
At home, they carried the machines on their backs.
And that wasn't all of it. The places that they worked in, so dark, some places hardly had any windows at all, no air. There was no such thing as air conditioning. Even today, a lot of the shops don't have it. But I mean to say, it wasn't at all like it is now. And as a matter of fact, till not so long ago, they had a few shops here downtown they have learned such holes that they gradually, they went out of business. That's how they got rid of them. But some of them, I remember when I used to be on the election committee and I used to go around and I used to think to myself, we thought we had it bad and I'm checking the mice, but they're even worse off.
I never had it bad in that contracting shop.
No.
It was light all the way around and it was clean and everything. And we lived across the alley from the shop, from the factory, from the shop. And when my baby was only 3 months old, I'd go home and nurse my baby at 10 o'clock in the morning. Then I'd go home at noon, I'd nurse my baby. Mother had something to eat for me and she took care of my children. My husband was a cripple, he had no hands, I had good work. And I'd go home at 10 o'clock and 3 o'clock in the afternoon and nurse my baby. And they were very good to me. They permitted me to do that just so as I wouldn't quit working.
Rose, what about your early experiences? Were you in a kind of shop that you were just describing? Or how?
Well, no, I worked for a big shop. I worked for High Check and Mice. And they more or less always led in everything. I mean, any benefits that we got, usually, they were the ones that...
There were so many contracting shops in Chicago,
yeah.
But I hate to tell you, on every corner there was a contracting shop, a small tailor.
Yeah.
And to organize all those small contracting shops, then they'd organize them, then they'd go out of business. They'd organize another shop, they'd go out of business.
Especially the pants shops, they would move out overnight because they didn't have much machinery to move. Like the coat shop had heavier machinery to move out. They would disappear overnight sometimes, especially when they went out to organize all these contracting shops. They'd move overnight, so they'd go in small towns over there. They don't have to pay the people so much an hour. Well, over here, they had to pay them according to, because High Chapner Marks would set an example for all the rest of the shops, you see? So all these small places, they used to try to move away. She was fortunate because she worked in a shop where the boss was more broad-minded. There were some that were decent. There were some. But the majority
of
the
work, I only made $4. Yeah. Of course, I didn't work. Then after I worked for a short time, then I got $5 a week, which meant a lot. But, the hours were unlimited. I mean, you know.
We used to work 54 hours, 60 hours a week from the beginning.
Sometimes before Easter on a Sunday, you had to work Thanksgiving.
Yeah. So so we got it down to 40, then we got it down to 36. And then, of course, the...
And after we worked 36, we went back to 40-ish.
Yeah, well, that was during the war, because we had to help in the war, but, you know. But we helped along in a lot of things, and during the war, the women's local was very active. We made bandages for the boys. First, we were going downtown to the Potter Palmer mansion. They donated part of their mansion to the Red Cross workers to make bandages. We used to go down there. Then we decided we got so many women active that were involved in the war because of having children in there or brothers and some husbands. So we opened up our own unit right here in the building. And the Red Cross was bringing us the work here and then picking it up from there because we figured as long as we were doing so much of it, we should be amalgamated credit for what they were doing. Because over there, naturally, the Potter Palmer, the society women, you know, were running it, and they were more or less getting the credit for it. So we figured we might as well get credit for what the labor women were doing because we used to come here right from work.